You're listening to Neurodiversity at Work.
Life can be so shaky. The way some people try to bring you down. Why they got to be so crazy? Always trying to give you the run around.
Welcome to today's episode, sponsored and powered by Dynamis Group. Recently honoured to be part of 300 years of leadership and innovation. We at Dynamis believe that business is a catalyst for positive impact in the world by building a bridge between the top leaders of today and the brightest leaders of tomorrow. We inspire them to do things they have never done before. And here we are for a special edition of Neurodiversity with Theo Smith and friends. Thank you all for joining us. This is an incredible session that we've got for you today. Please do get involved. Put your comments in, ask your questions, share your experiences, because that's what this is about today. We are bringing together three warrior mums who are going to be sharing their experiences of having exceptionally gifted autistic children. And, you know, their journeys have kind of similarities and connections. And you're going to find out more about that as we go along. But what's important to know is all our children are unique and different, right? So anybody tuning into the show today, please do get involved, do ask questions, but also know every single one's life experience is unique and different. So I'm very pleased to have these warrior mums here today. We're going to introduce themselves, but do get involved in the chat as well. This is an open dialogue. Hi, Charlie. Good morning. We've already got people coming in and commenting. Great to have you here. So if we can get going, and first we can come around. And Joy, maybe you want to start with introducing yourself. Thank you very much and welcome.
Thank you, Theo. We appreciate the opportunity to be here. And I am Joy Young. I am currently a neurodiversity educator and consultant. I am the wife of 42 years to an autistic psychologist. After 24 failed adoptions, we adopted two beautiful children who, in the end, one being autistic and the other being ADHD. I'm a veteran educator. And so this is personal to me, but it's professional. It all fits together. And I'm just glad that we can meet with others. I was thrilled to meet both Marie and Teresa and learn that our stories intersected in so many ways. So thanks for having us.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And Marie, nicely on to you. If you'd love to introduce yourself to the audience, as people are coming in and saying how excited they are to hear the stories today.
Fantastic. Well, I'm Marie and I'm from Derbyshire in England. I'm a parent carer to my son, Zach, who was diagnosed with autism at 3 years old. He's now 20. He's been in the system quite some time. I do campaigning, advocacy. I run live sessions on Twitter to support people because I know how it feels to be isolated. So I'm here to share my lived experience and our personal journey.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And Teresa, over to you.
So that leaves it with me. So I'm Dr. Teresa Haskins, and I'm Dr. Teresa Haskins thanks to my neurodivergent sons, because I never even knew that was going to be in my life journey. So I'm a professor at the University of Southern California, and much like Joy and Marie, worked tirelessly to figure out a path for my kids because the system wasn't working for them. We found a path, and then we realized other people were on this journey. And while we've just met each other recently, we know that there are countless people just like us trying to figure out, if depending on the age and stage, and we actually span a few generations together, which is why I think we're such an awesome force. But, you know, if your child's young, how do I get them educated? Then you get them educated. Will they go to college? Will they get a job? If they're an adult, what is their lifespan? Like, will they ever live independently? And so that's the things we're always talking about. And that's what the three of us are also working towards. So nice to meet everybody. Hey.
Brilliant. And that's lovely. So, and it's also incredible that you come together from different experiences, different parts of the world, and yet so much resonates and connects with you. And I think we're in a world where sometimes it's on many different aspects of our life's journey, right? But we can often feel alone. We can feel like there's not other people going through the same journey. As I mentioned before, because everybody's an individual, right? Individual child, individual relationships and parents, we're all different and unique. That can sometimes make us feel like when we do hear other stories that don't resonate, it can make us feel even more alone, right? Because sometimes in those community chats and things like that, there are so many things that just we may not resonate with. So when you get three people come together in different places and places in the world, and so much resonates, I find that very powerful. And I think that's why a lot of people are tuning in today to hear those wonderful journeys. So Joy, do you just want to tell us a little bit more about your experiences up to date? Anything you'd like to share with the audience before we get into the questions?
Before we get into the questions, I just want everyone to know that we're here for you. I think that was what brought us together. And Theo, you and I have had wonderful conversations about parenting and the complexities of it. And to Teresa's point, it is very isolating. You're with your neighbors, you're watching other children, and you're having comments about your child should do this or you should stop that. And family members are, I think, sometimes the most caring, but the most hurtful with the comments they make. And so I think I want everyone to know this, we're here for you today to hopefully maybe say something where you can say, wow, that happened to me too. And to not be alone. I know that all of us are available to you. I have a dream that one day we won't be having this conversation because people will understand. Real quick comment, being left-handed when I first started teaching was a terrible thing. And I was actually taught in teacher's college to force children to use their right hands. Take the scissors and put it in the right hand. Take the pencil. I knew of one teacher who actually tied a child's hand behind their back. Well, we now know neurologically that left-handedness is from the brain, and no longer are teachers being taught to do that. But they're saying, no, you're left-handed. Let me, you know, put you on the end of the row or whatever. My dream is one day with neurodiversity, we will quit having these conversations and just say, hey, we're all different.
Brilliant. And we're just going to comment in from LinkedIn user saying, you're absolutely correct, Joy. Our families are still in denial. And I think there is a generational impact there as well, where, people felt like the way that they were going to be treated was negative. Therefore, they wanted to hush it up. They didn't want to talk about it, which is so many things in our life experiences that we don't want to do. So, Teresa, over to you. Anything you'd like to share before we get on into the questions?
I think Joy really summed it up best, but it's one of the things that folks need to realize is that everybody fears things they don't know. And one of the things Joy, Marie, and I connected on is that when we started our journeys 20, 30, 40 years ago, these were not things we talked about. One of the things, Theo, that and everyone on the line that you know, is that there's this new identity first language, right? We say, I'm autistic now, but you're looking at faces that were actually part of the movement when we were just at the beginning trying to get people to say the word autism without a horribly negative connotation. So like I spent a lot of time educating people that person first language started because we were trying to get the majority to see people with autism as a person, not a disability. It's a point of pride, actually, to be able to fast forward and to have a whole generation of people saying, I'm autistic, I'm proud, and that our society has moved forward enough that we have the space to do that. But as Joy said, there's like a ton of work to be done, because the truth is we do not live in future state. And if we lived in future state, Theo, Joy, Marie, and I would probably be talking about something else online, because I think we're warriors of sorts. But the fact is we're in a circle and we get it. And everybody outside of that circle is trying to get it or not. And that's what we're really working on. So if you find that people don't get it, don't be too frustrated, because that's why we're here. We're trying to help them learn. We don't live in the future state. We're working to build one together. So I think that's one of the things we always want to remember. We don't live there yet. We're creating the paths to get there.
Absolutely. And you only have to stand in the street. You only have to stand on the schoolyard. You only have to stand in an office to hear still misunderstandings, people being quite negative, people being fearing the topic and subject. So that really resonates with me, you know, and those people are leaders. Those people are taxi drivers and police officers and, you know, pickers and packers and whatever, right? They're everywhere. So I always think these conversations that we have here can influence way beyond our own circles and that of work, because those people exist everywhere. So I'm so happy we can discuss this topic. Marie, anything you would like to share with the audience?
Well, obviously, Teresa and Joy have mentioned most of the things that I would have said. But to add on top of that, I would say that, you know, we're constantly battling a system that's not really fit for purpose. You know, our children are thrown into education where there's not enough training done. There's hardly any at all. There's very little understanding. You know, I only went into a school a couple of weeks ago and the head teacher said, oh, I think they can have an EHC until they're nearly 18. And I said, well, actually, it's 25. And, you know, it kind of takes you back, because I can remember being back in that school situation and I didn't know the power of the health and education plan. I didn't understand the law. And it wasn't until 5 years ago, when we hit that dark place and Zach didn't want to be here anymore and we'd exhausted everything, that I really started to learn the true power, because I was actually doing it myself. So I think, you know, we need to educate an awful lot of people out there. And the worrying thing is, for us, the people that have got us through are the people who aren't being paid to get us through. They're the nice people who do care, who do want to make a difference, and who have taken time to help Zach progress. And obviously me with the advocacy and, you know, the campaigning, the spreading the word, the making a difference and improving inclusion. So there's an awful lot of work to be done. I think that kind of sums it up for me, really. Yeah, too much work, too little time. And we need more people to spread the word and more people to listen and think differently and make changes. Because if that doesn't happen, we're not going anywhere, are we?
Absolutely. And just to for our global audience, EHCP, Educational Health and Care Plan, specific to the UK, you'll have different things globally, or you may not. This is the problem that we have, right? Which is governmental support, intervention, finance to support children who are ADHD or autistic or co-occurring conditions or traits, however you want to define them. But that is the UK specific funding and support that's available up until the age of 25. I just want to get into now kind of the body of what we're going to be talking about. And we're going to take you on a journey now, an exciting journey, through kind of the early challenges and revelations, the moving, shifting paradigms, education and advocacy, and also post-education employment, and then building partnerships and advocacy. So today, these three incredible women are going to share with you that journey and their experiences between them. So we'll just crack right on. And first of all, Teresa, can we start with you? Can you just tell us about your early experiences, kind of when you realized the system, the education system or any old system, when we focus on that, when you realized actually this system is not working for me and my children, and what you then did with that?
So it was from the beginning. I mean, maybe not day one beginning, but it was way earlier than the first times in education. One of the first times I realized that we might have some problems with Braden's journey was when he was about 1.5 years old. In the United States, we actually have a developmental checklist that your pediatrician goes over with you at every wellness check. And Braden wasn't hitting the milestones on the form. But by age, I think he was 15 months, he could count to 100 and he knew his ABCs. But he had never said mom or hello. He didn't wave. He didn't respond. And so when you looked at the developmental checklist, he was completely deficient. And it was a significant problem. And so the parade of psychologists and speech pathologists and hearing tests to make sure, like, his hearing's fine. But these are all the things they do to just rule out any problems. So it started there. And I remember saying to his pediatrician, what about his ability to count to 100? or what about his ability to like say all these letters? And she's like, well, I'm not really convinced he's doing that because he only does it when you ask him to do it. And that's because he's not a circus monkey. He doesn't like to perform. Fast forward, they put him in a developmental preschool. He's reading. So he's 3-4 years old, reading to the class. We're getting ready to put him into kindergarten. That's around 5-6 in the United States. And obviously, at this point, you don't know this, so it's not obvious, but I was concerned about him entering a regular school because he already knew all the planets. He was doing basic, like, you know, elementary physics. He was probably at a 3rd to 5th grade level in math already, if not higher. And I remember sitting at the table with an educational psychologist, teachers from like K-4, and the educational psychologist was adamant that he needed to be in kindergarten. And I said, well, what's he going to learn while he's at school? And the 3rd grade teacher goes, he could help teach the class. And they were being funny about it, but it wasn't funny. We left that kind of brokenhearted. He had just finished his, they had just did a big intelligence test. His IQ is over 145. They actually stopped it after 3 days because for state standards, high enough. I'm in Ohio. And we just realized we're going to have to do it ourselves. So when I met you, when I introduced myself to all of you, I said, I'm a doctor because of my son. I went and got my master's in educational psychology so I could figure out how to develop a learning program for my son because nobody was around to help. No parent should have to do that. And then when I realized I could educate my sons and that they were learning faster than I could keep up, I've been in corporate America for over 2 decades. And I look around the corporate office and think, as brilliant as my kids are, they will never get a job here. So that's when I went and got my doctorate. And that's when I'm now spending my life to figure out how we actually create cultures and spaces to fit these people. But that's how I knew the system was broken. There are checklists that measure whether you fit or not. And if you're not, his skills weren't on the checklist, they were just dismissed. And no one was willing to make the space for it because they don't, it's almost like most of our society has to have a recipe. And without the recipe, doesn't matter how great the ingredient is, it's just dismissed. So that's what I have found about the system. And what can be really hard for parents is not everybody has the luxury to have a parent stay home to execute the homeschooling programs. Like, I do realize I'm coming from a place of privilege, but at the same time, I can tell you in my experience, if I hadn't been able to do those things, I don't know where my children would be because the system, a lot of parents depend on the system to do the right thing. And I think everybody's going to learn today, not just with my story, the system, it's not because they weren't willing to do the right thing. They literally didn't know what to do. And every once in a while, I meet young people that are like, oh, I want to be a special education teacher. I want to be an intervention specialist. Young people, let me tell you, that's where I started when I went back to school because of my son. I opted out of the program because they were teaching me to do things I knew were wrong and I knew I didn't want to do. And I raised my hand and I said, who comes up with this stuff? That's not actually the word I used. And the professor said, educational psychologist. And I go, why? This doesn't work. He goes, it has to be evidence-based. I go, how do I get that job? And so that's how I became me. I switched programs. So what I think is frustrating to me is I love Joy Marie and you, Theo. I think we're doing great things, but it's infuriating that this is what it's taken for my kids to be successful, that if I didn't do this, and somebody just mentioned something about a child going to university, I broke the system. Both of my kids entered university at 12 and 14. And yes, they're smart boys, but I also curated learning programs to their strengths. They've never been told they were a deficit, not a day in their life. So I think that that's something with the system too. If we're measuring people in ways that always shows them that they're never good enough, they're not going to thrive in areas that they will. And I'm not an astrophysicist. I can't do calculus. So I don't know why we have to be that way. And so that's my view of the system. It's not just broken because it doesn't deliver what people need. It's broken because they actually don't have the solution.
Yeah, that's incredible. Thank you. And I'm just sharing a message from Paige there. I appreciate your story, Dr. Haskins. I have a very similar journey with my son who is now in college. I appreciate the pioneering work you are all doing. And it is infuriating And I have to say that your story there, Teresa, around your journey, I see that, and I see that I see that a lot with women pioneering in this space because of exactly the reasons that you said. And I can get frustrated, and I do the work that I'm doing, but the amount of doctors who are now there because they're so frustrated with what they saw, that's the journey they then went on, which I think is incredible, and it is absolutely changing the narrative now around how we see neurodiversity as a concept and autism and ADHD. So just thank you, that is incredible. So Marie, when did you first realize that your child was exceptionally gifted? And then how would that affect your approach to parenting, the way that you saw yourself and your child?
Oh, gosh. I guess like Teresa, he was always very different from the start, but maybe I didn't recognise. Looking back, I can see it. But back then, I didn't know anything about disability. I didn't know anybody autistic. I was just floundering because he was just very, very different to any of my friends' children. And at that point, I didn't know that he had these gifts. I mean, Zach at 3 years old, when he was diagnosed, he only had two words. One was no, and he still doesn't like the word no. And the second one was haircut, and he grew his hair waist length. Now I know it was because of sensory issues and all that sort of thing. But it's a learning curve that is very, very steep. And, you know, I remember back then, 20 years ago, health visitors didn't know. The doctor told me I was absolutely crazy. Just adopt super nanny tactics. You know, you put them into school. In my opinion, I could see where he was being mismanaged. And the trauma started to build really back then, which I guess inhibited his spirit really. And I think that's another observation that I've certainly made, is that the trauma just builds and it just creeps up and it's just added to. Looking back, Zach used to draw motorways and electricity pylons when he was kind of 2 years old before he could speak. He couldn't tell me what they were, but he would just draw them on reams of paper. Looking back again, he at 5 months old, I've got photographs of being able to work the little play systems. He couldn't even sit up. He was kind of 5 months old, if that. And he was propped up by cushions, but he knew to twist and flick and all the things that, looking back, I'd never had any children before. So I thought that was all kids could do that. And so I guess ours was kind of trauma related for years. The educational system, we tried everything over here. Mainstream, nobody understood him. Special units, individualized autistic, school specialist, government funded, independent specialist schools. Nothing worked. He hated school because he wasn't the slightest bit interested in the curriculum. And he just switched off. So, you know, I would get reports saying, you know, there was nothing that was remotely average. He can't use punctuation. He can't do this. He can't do that. And it's my opinion that they almost broke his spirit. And so our change came 5 years ago when Zach just didn't want to be here anymore. He said, "Mom, I know it's law that kids have to go to school. And I just don't know. I can't go on. I can't face this." He was having, he's been sick from anxiety, panic attacks. It was major stuff. And that's when I researched, thinking, oh, what am I going to do? We've reached the end of the road. We've tried everything. We've run out of ideas. So I researched this personal educational budget against his health and education plan. And that's really when I started to learn more about Zach, because I could push forward. I could pull back. I could build everything in that he wasn't able to access in a traditional setting. Because his anxieties lessened, the panic attacks stopped overnight. And also, well, I wanted a remedy, really. I wanted a remedy, something good, something positive to happen to Zach. So I thought back to a time, which was a point that at the time didn't really mean too much, but I thought, I can remember 4 years prior, we'd gone on a careers day and Zach had asked a question. Costain were doing a presentation on structural engineering. And somehow Zach had noticed that going up the M1 motorway at 70 miles an hour, a bridge footing was slightly different to the rest. And he asked the question. None of the other kids in the school were remotely interested in this engineering side of things. So they couldn't answer. And he got Google Earth up and he was showing them, you know, exactly what he meant. Anyway, they said, we'll write to you. We'll find out, Zach, and we'll write to you, of which they did. They gave him a real comprehensive breakdown and an open-ended visit. So I thought, I wonder if they'll remember this kid who they said was, you know, amazing on that particular day. Luckily, they did. How can we forget Zach? You're not going to come across another Zach. They organised a bespoke day, which then kind of led into lots of work experience. And it's once I saw Zach in with his people, speaking his language, he could converse. And then they introduced us to their tier two. So, even more suppliers. So we're quite a household name. And then one of those contacts that I used via social networking and social media introduced it into the power transmission, of which, you know, we're now into National Grid, Morrison's Energy Services. And that's at the point that I always knew he was different. I always knew he was special. I knew he got this hypervigilance and this photographic memory. What I didn't realise was how much he knew, because, you know, we're at the Innovation Centre with National Grid, with people who've worked there for 30 years. And Zach's already got the solution. You know, they were talking about a solution. And Zach said, well, it won't work because you have to do this and that, and you have to change that and reweight that and resize. And the comment came from the manager. Actually, it's one of the engineers, the senior engineers. And he said, that's exactly the length we've got to go to, Zach, to make it work. So I remember sitting next to the manager and him saying, well, can you tell me why it's taking you months then? And then we've got this kid who's done it for a hobby. I've only met three people who can live with Zach's technical expertise. And, you know, bear in mind, he's just turned 20 and he's had this technical expertise since he was 15. It's just the fact that we didn't know anybody enough to be able to test it. And since he had his personal educational budget, he's passed all his English exams. He knows exactly, you know, how to use his punctuation. But he said, Mum, my PDA just got in the way and it will only accept things I'm interested in. So give Zach something he's interested in. He's amazing. Now we've got three work placement offers. When actually the system told us from a very early age he was never do anything, he'd never be any good, he'd never get a job. And, you know, the local authority were writing without formal qualifications, his journey to employment will be severely hampered and depict the type of employment he can access. Well, you know, let National Grid and Morrison's Energy and Costain, go back there. And I think it's just sad, really, because you can see the trauma building in our children. And, you know, and again, like Dr. Teresa, I had to do it myself, because I was just fed up of him being let down. But the trauma is almost irreversible in the, what happens to them over a period of time. And I just think that just needs to change. And that's why I do what I do with the advocacy and the speaking up. And that's how I met you wonderful people.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. Just this comment that's come in that I'd like then to ask you, Joy. I guess reflecting on some of what we've just talked about and on your own life experiences, Matthew Harrison has made a really great point here that one of the hardest things is finding out what is causing distress, anxiety. I often can't understand what's behind my own problems, and my son, even though he's very eloquent and was very, very early talker, seems unable to work out what's troubling him and gets frustrated and doesn't want to talk about it. So I get this as well in terms of myself and my child. It's a journey because nobody's given you the textbook on it. It's like you're having to learn, like me, the way that I'm having to learn why I'm stressed out and I've got anxiety and why I'm struggling to communicate with my daughter. At the same point that she's stressed out and she's got anxiety. And so I'm there trying to be the dad to help, and she needs help, but I need help at that moment as well. It's like, ah! So what you said there, Marie, is you you've learned a lot, right, over that period of time, and that you can now, it really helps you support your son in those instances, and it helps him be able to communicate, I guess, some of his challenges. So Joy, what reflecting back, what can you share with us, your thoughts on those feelings?
Yeah, great question. And the conversation, again, as when we first met, is certainly resonating with me. So many of these areas being crossovers. I do want to go back to something you said at the beginning, Theo, is that each and every one of our children are different. And so one of the things I've learned recently, and it's actually only been the last few years, is to ask myself the question, what am I missing? I think it's a powerful question. It is my tagline. If we look at our children, and we look at ourselves, behavior is a form of communication. So when these behaviors, which we are making assumptions about, they mean one thing, but they don't seem to quite fit or seem right, the behavior potentially could be something else. We need to stop, hard to do in a fast-paced society, and ask myself, with my child, with myself, what am I missing? What's not quite right here? So to fill in a couple gaps, my son Sean is 35, so he's the oldest of the three. And we say we were autism before autism was cool, because back in 1996, when he got his diagnosis, I was a up-and-coming teacher in the largest school system in the Southeast here in the U.S. I was headed for administration. We had his first grade teacher write on his report card, Sean needs to pay more attention. Sean was adopted at 4. He didn't speak to us, but we assumed that it was because he came from a Korean mother and he didn't speak English. He entertained himself for hours on end. He was the perfect adopted child. Again, we missed so much. When that report came home, we sat down with Sean and we said, Sean, your teacher says you're not paying attention. He very quickly said, Mom, I'm making straight A's. I'm definitely paying attention. It was because he was not making eye contact, an autistic trait, because it was truly physically painful for him. And he said, I don't know why people stare each other in the eyes anyway. How long am I supposed to keep doing this? That behavior, she made an assumption with. Our schooling continued in that vein. Long story short, when he was making the transition from in the US, our elementary school to middle school, the IEP meeting that we had went something like this. Oh, we're so glad Sean's coming to our school. Meet Mrs. Smith. She's the new teacher that's going to be teaching these children in special education. At this point, we did have an evaluation done. He identified as autistic. Mrs. Smith says, no, I should pick another name, Theo. That's yours. Mrs. Jones says, oh, I'm so glad to have Sean in my class. I've heard about autism. I don't know anything about it, but I'm happy to learn. My husband kicked me under the table and said, not on my kid. So we left public school. At this point, I am an administrator. We went to a small private school thinking he needed just to be known. If people just knew Sean, he would do better. Long story short with that was a crash and burn the first 6 weeks. He had pages and pages of long division problems to do. He was making an F in mathematics. He was very depressed, to follow Marie's statement with Zach, extremely depressed. We took him out because my husband says at this point, well, public school didn't work, private school didn't work. I guess you'll need to homeschool him. Please understand, I am a public school principal at this point, but as moms and as dads, we know this, you do what your children need. We asked Sean, design your perfect school for us. Tell us, what does this school look like? He said, it's a school where I can study the things I like most of the time. I know I have to do English and spelling. It's a school where I can stay focused on one subject for a really long time. When we keep changing classes every 45 minutes, it hurts my brain and I can't ever get back to where I started when we have to get up and go to the next class or go to the recess. He said, it's a school where they don't have those flickering lights. They really caused me to have a headache, Mom. He went through this list, and homeschool for us was that solution. Now you may say, well, you're an educator, that's easy. I couldn't educate this kid. I have a degree in early childhood. I'm a great kindergarten teacher. But to Marie's point and to Reese as well, these kids are doing things that just doesn't even fit in my skill set. Long story short, we began to find resources and people around us. We reached out to our tribe. Sean had mentors, and we would have him go shadow a friend for a day at work. He went to some office in downtown Atlanta and spent the day at this computer company. He fell in love with it. He came back, and again, he shared so much of what he knew. But all along the way, we kept missing things. We kept misinterpreting behavior. One of the things that we quickly learned was, Theo, being around neurotypicals does not make you neurotypical. You don't absorb this stuff to look, quote, quote, normal, whatever that is. But we also learned that emphasizing and focusing on strengths is extremely important. And of course, those who are kind of following the neurodiversity movement know that we talk about this thing called spiky profiles. Sean was doing long division problems, failing because he doesn't have quick recall of his multiplication tables. To this day, he still uses a calculator to do 3 times 9. When we took him out and put him in homeschool, he immediately flew through algebra 1, algebra 2, and immediately within 6 months, he was in a calculus book. So I realized then each behavior I needed to stop and say, if this is not working, let's not make an assumption, but let's ask the question, what am I missing?
Yes.
I'd also like to add as well, because everything that Joy's saying is right, but I would say divided into two main areas, and that is try and look for the triggers, but also be mindful, because there's usually something that is triggering it. And that's what Joy's saying. You've got to find out the missing bit. So that missing bit might be an irritating poster on a wall in a classroom. It might be that they can hear a noise that you can't hear. And also bear in mind, there can be a sensory delay as well. So it could be something that's upset them 2 weeks prior to. So that's just to give you an idea of, it can be really complex, and you have to know your children inside out to get to that point. But as Joy's just said, you know, find your tribe, to the person who's written in. I run my support sessions live every Friday morning. You can dial into them. You can ask questions. You know, we can put you in contact with people who will help point you in the right direction. You will learn from lived experience, and that's usually other parents, which is exactly what we all are. So, yeah, you know, look for those triggers. It's quite tricky.
And then the thing to add, as we all pile on,
yep.
One of the things that I think is hardest, and then we'll go to the next topic that you want to, Theo, but one of the things that's hard is that, and I just saw somebody say they have a 3-year-old nonverbal autistic child. You want to see what's missing, but we need to be patient in the sense of, there are things that triggered my son that I wouldn't learn about the trigger for like 2 years. And so one of the things that we need to be better at is actually acknowledging that autism is a disability. And there may be people saying, oh, of course it is. Well, if we believe it's a disability, then you wouldn't believe that they could mitigate their disability with therapy or strategies. And while we want to teach our children strategies to better navigate a neurotypical world, I see a lot of the world in my early experiences trying to make a blind person not blind. So we really need to think about what is a developmental appropriate path for my child, while still actually acknowledging and respecting that they have a disability in that area. If your child has executive functioning issues, it's not because they won't improve over time, but they will probably never get to typical because that's the disability. But that's one of the things that I think can be very challenging. And I'm going to go back to the three-year-old parent on the line. People want to understand right now what is wrong so we can fix it tomorrow. You're going to have to probably give yourself and your child grace. And if the teacher can't do that, you may have to just change the situation for a while to a point when your child isn't triggered anymore to even determine what the problem is. And if they're young, right? How many 3 or 4 year olds, typical or autistic, can really articulate their needs effectively? So it could take time to unpack that. And I think you need to give you and your child grace that if a situation is triggering, you may not understand it. You don't have to understand it today, but you do need to get them out of that stressful environment.
And Theo, I want to tag on. We could go for days, but I want to tag on the sensory piece of this, because so many of the things we're talking about, the triggers, the experiences are sensory. So if we think about that and are aware of that, we, to Marie's point, our kids hear and see things that aren't even on our radar because we don't have that sensitivity. One of the things that we learned when Sean went off to a small college was that he was walking across the university in the snow with no coat on. Now, fortunately, we had a wonderful person there that was kind of keeping an eye on him. Sean doesn't sense hot and cold in the same way that a lot of people do. And so it wasn't he was being careless or he was just being a clumsy adolescent and he was just in a hurry. He didn't feel the cold. It was dangerous. The other piece that we found out is there are so many, the brain's so complex, but Sean has something called prosopagnosia. It's face blindness. He had high anxiety the first semester, which was a crash and burn, and that's a long story. But he does not recognize, not names, he doesn't recognize faces. And if you go online and read prosopagnosia, there's a percent of the population, 5 to 10% that aren't even autistic that have this. But he didn't recognize his roommate in the dining hall. So when his roommate would say, come sit with us, he wouldn't join him. He didn't know a professor when he crossed his path. This is a school with 4,000 kids and it's small. And so every time someone spoke to him, it was as if it was his first day all over again. His anxiety was off the charts. We didn't learn this, and it's a long story, but we found out literally years later, to Teresa's point, that he has prosopagnosia. It's changed how we navigate life. But that anxiety, when I think about how nervous I was when I first started college, that you would go through an entire semester and not know anybody, even the person in your own room, that's painful. Those are the messy, slippery parts. But again, that's why we need each other to share this journey.
That's wonderful. Thank you. And I want to go and touch on the point of disability as well, because what we've got to remember is the environments that we live in today, they may be 100, 200, 300 years max, right? We live on a planet that's been here for 5.6 billion years, right, in development. We have the human brain, the modern human brain that sits in our head, right? If we think of the time it's taken for that brain to optimize to the planet that we live in, we're talking a really long period of time. Yet the world we live in today, the bright lights, the noisy environments, the traffic, the electric vehicles, the ChatGPT, right? 10 years, 50 years, 100 years, 150 years, globalization, industrialization, the Internet of Things. Like, it's no wonder that it is a disability in that context, because the brain has not had time to adapt and will not have time to adapt for this world that we've built without little consideration for the impact that it's had on the human brain. And I think it's really important to remember that as well, because that can give us some control over the environments we choose, where we put ourselves, where we put our children, you know, and the sensory needs and the impact on them. And I think I think from many comments as well, you know, there's a lot of comments on the nonverbal, child still nonverbal, so really struggling to connect with your child's sensory needs and challenges. And I know from here in the UK, there is still a lack of funding. Actually, the funding's being stripped out again. There is still a lack of due care and consideration for parents. And that's why so many of you have to run off and educate yourself to become the expert, because there is no expert sat there waiting to help you. And again, so powerful that we're here today to be discussing this topic. So sorry, I just
and
wanted
Theo, to... you yes. know, as you throw that out, I have these moments. So you just made one happen. That if you think about that transition of how we started as primitive people and who we are today, language is a fairly new development in terms of not just spoken language, but written language. So if you think about it, how we communicate today is based on the language areas of the brains. But there was a time where people communicated, they didn't even have symbols. It was you saw a bush, you were hunting. And so, you know, this is a great point, something I think we should study more about how we've evolved as a society may have actually accentuated this issue, where in other societies it might not be an issue at all if they're not as technologically based and verbal dependent.
And that is one thing we're starting to learn now a lot more, well, slowly, unfortunately, but the global element of this, right? That we are all at different stages of growth, development, transformation. We may live in a small tribe, we may live in a big city, and all of that is going to, you're right, will impact on whether this is a major barrier to us being able to succeed in life versus not. I sometimes think, wouldn't it just be better for our family and my daughter if we just lived on a farm somewhere, like out, away, like that? I just think it would solve so many of the challenges, barriers, and problems. But of course, that's not reason. We can't go back to a time where we can all just become farmers again or hunter-gatherers or whatever it is, right? We the reality is we live in this world and there's many opportunities in this world, but there is some real painful barriers that we find and that maybe were being hidden from us. Or it was like, don't look over there. Don't look over there, you know. We're sorry that your child is victim of all these problems, but no, Don't Look Up is the great film, isn't it? Don't Look Up, right? Of this terrible disaster that's happening to us. As long as you don't look up, it's not a problem. So we've got probably about 15 minutes left and already covered so many wonderful things and the audience getting involved, which is lovely. And so many of them saying how much this resonates with them. So why don't we talk a little bit about we talked a bit about the education system, your children's journey, some of the barriers, taking them out. What about some advocacy work now? Roy, would you like to share with us? Because this has come up from other people pre this event asking the question as well. Where do you lean in? Where do you lean out? How much of your story do you give up? How much of your child's story do you share? How, you know, when do you know as a parent if you're doing too much or too little? And I know this is difficult, right? But I know there's a lot of parents out there, they're struggling with this, you know, should I be talking to my child about this or should I just be quietly helping them? Should I be telling other people in the community? Should I be putting them up on social media? Should I be myself up on social media? Well, what are your thoughts on this, Joy? How have you found the balance?
What a messy question, Theo. It is so messy. So one of the first things is that I really encourage everyone to don't go alone. I think that's one of the big statements. And I know oftentimes we find ourselves as single parents and we feel alone. Is again, find someone. My husband and I are both cancer survivors and we have had to fight cancer and we've had to fight for our marriage. And what I want to say to you is fight for your family and don't go alone. It's too much. And so whether it's a friend, whether it's a family member, whether it's someone you meet on LinkedIn, find someone to travel that journey. Because one of the things that I've learned is that compassion and accountability are not mutually exclusive. So you have to understand, again, I'm that school teacher that used to say, oh, you're going to homeschool your kid, you're going to ruin them for life. I've had to undo a lot of my learnings and my thoughts. And again, we hear that family member, grandparents in particular, y'all, our grandparents love their grandbabies. And it's not how they would do it because they don't have the knowledge and information. So keep in mind, number one, if you're the parent, I truly believe a parent knows their child better than anyone. I am a strong believer in that. But number two, you're not going to convince some of these people. So find that person that would be your confidant and travel the journey with you. The other thing that we have always said to our son is, Sean, the autism explains why you did what you just did. It doesn't excuse it. When Sean was 7 years old, he went into his computer lab at his school. And again, we're talking a long time ago where they would line the computers up in the lab and they'd take the whole class in and everyone sit down. Sean was always asked to help the teacher with the computers because he just knew. And so one day he decided that the password that controlled the entire computer lab was not secure. This was a problem to him. He is a rule follower. And so Sean changed the password to the master computer to 40 computers in the lab. Well, it shut it down because no one else had it. And so for 3 days, none of the kids in the school got to go to the computer lab because no one could figure it out until they finally said, you know what? I think Sean was the last one to be here. And when asked, he said, oh, I was just worried about the security. So I updated the master password. Well, that autism and his rule following explained why I did what he did and didn't excuse it. We wrote letters to everybody. We apologized. So again, I think we walk this delicate balance of how these kids' brains work. They do have to also function in society. I spent 3 years at Ernst & Young supporting computer programmers. One of the things I learned in the corporate setting was you just said and did this thing that you thought was best because of how your brain works. However, that client's getting ready to leave based upon what you did. I can be compassionate and understand and support you, but you also have to be accountable that here's the result of that and let's see what we can do to work on this. So I do think it has two sides. An important lesson for me though, my husband is the compassionate one. He's the psychologist. I'm the accountable one. I'm the school principal. They're not mutually exclusive.
Brilliant. And then Theo, you asked about parent advocacy, how much to share, how much not to share. So I think my recommendation to parents is proceed with caution. And why I say that is you were looking at three people who really didn't get vocal until our children were much older. So no fault to anybody, but the truth is I remember over a decade ago, somebody said, Teresa, you should write a book. And for those that know me, know I'm still sitting on a draft of that book because when my son was 3 or 7, I didn't feel I knew his story yet. His experiences at 3 at 5 do not make me an expert in terms of what his journey and path would be. And if you are a new parent just working with a 3-year-old child, your lived experience, you're not an expert. You're just an expert on your child. So I think that we want to be really mindful that you do need to find community. And there are lots of parent groups where parents that have issues can connect. And I think you try to do that in close small groups. I think that if you look at what Marie and Joy and I are talking about, we try to talk more about things that are scalable, more generalizable, and things that we've learned about over time. And the other thing is, I think like in Marie's case, you might be like, well, she talks about her son with PDA, and I don't mean to talk for you, Marie, but her son is part of her advocacy. He is side by side with what she's doing. He's on board. She's not doing it about him. They're doing it together. So I know that there's a movement where it's like parents shouldn't be talking about their children, right, Theo? What is the question? And I think it's how we talk about our children. So I do talk about my experience, but if you think about it, I talk about it from my perspective of how I built structures, what I needed to support my child. You don't hear us talking about like, oh, it was hard and so tiring. And by the way, it is exhausting. My son hasn't slept in a decade, and I can say that because he's 17 and he still doesn't sleep. So these are the things that when you think about, should I advocate for your child, advocate for their needs, work in ways that you can find others to support them in areas of strengths. If you feel that the system is broken and you want to go after the system, this is when it's good to start working with others because that's where numbers are power. So there's the things you can advocate for the individual, and then there's advocating for this, you know, changes within the system. And that's when things, that's when the community becomes key.
Brilliant. Marie, do you have anything to add?
I absolutely agree, yeah, with everything that's just been said. And I think, you know, I use the word find your tribe. And I think it's really important to find your tribe because everything I've learned has been either from the web or from other parents, and other parents get it. They just do. And it's strange, really, because if I hit a real rough patch, I'll pick up the phone to Beth in Surrey, who I'd never even met at that point in time. You know, I've met her two or three times since now. And, you know, but that's very odd, isn't it, to have to reach out to somebody you've never met in person. I've never met Joy. I've never met Teresa. But they are people who I would feel comfortable in reaching out because they just get it. So, yeah, find other people like you in your, it's never going to be the same, but there's some common threads and they will have felt it at some time in the past. And the guidance they can give you, the direction they can give you, and the time they can save you by just pointing you at an Equality Act or the Children and Families Act or an IPSEA website or a standard letter is immeasurable. So I would say that to everybody. And obviously I'm always happy to help. Every time I go into one of the offices on Zach's work experience, a minimum of one person will seek me out. Some are senior management, some are just, you know, feet on the street, to say, I'm struggling with my child, or, you know, work have no idea. I don't want to bring it into work. I don't want to discuss it with work. But if I'd got somebody like you, I would have known where to go to get that letter. And I wouldn't have had to take the 6 weeks off or whatever with my mental health because I was struggling. So I think it is important to have that point of contact where it's impartial. You're not going to get judged. It's away from everything else. But you're heard and you're validated.
Incredible. Thank you. And I absolutely agree. I'd never met Amanda Kirby, who I ended up writing a book with. And the first time we met was at an awards for the book. And it just seems odd, yeah. But I met her at a crisis point in COVID where I was struggling and I needed to do something about it because of my work and my child. Yeah. And you're right. It sometimes it's not the person next to you. It's the person that can understand where you're at, and they may be on the other side of the world, right? But that's okay. We can communicate in this way now. So I know there's a lot of parents, carers, people who work with young people who will be watching this now and will very much appreciate you sharing the journey, which I think for a lot of them, from what I'm seeing in the messages, they may be very early on in that journey. And therefore facing some significant barriers of learning and understanding. So I know they're going to really appreciate the time that you've gifted to them today. So I'd just like to finally bring it to a close and ask the three of you, you know, what would you like the audience to go away with? Or what kind of future do you hope for? And any tools, resources that you would like to share? Teresa, if I could start with you.
Did you say me?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. You know, since you said that there's a lot of folks that are indicating that they're early on the journey, I think from this conversation, there's a few things to take away. And then I know that Joy has some resources that'll really help you. But the first thing, if you didn't hear Marie say it, you're not alone. It can feel isolating because in your bubble, in your circle, in your family, in your community, you may be the only one, but globally there is this huge community. So reach out. If you're not certain how to find that community, reach out to us. We'd be happy to connect you. The second thing is, three-year-olds are hard no matter what. So whether they're typical or autistic, three-year-olds are hard. Everybody matures and grows up whether they're autistic. So what you're experiencing today will evolve and get easier. You'll have different challenges in the future, but every toddler is a challenge, and an autistic challenge an autistic toddler may come with some additional challenges, but they doesn't necessarily make it harder. It just makes it different. And then that would be number three, reframe what you're seeing. You know, if I made a checklist of everything my son could do and compared it to his classmates, remember he was reading to his classmates, they wouldn't have measured up to him. They couldn't do math. They couldn't read. They didn't know they were learning their ABCs. He was teaching the ABCs. So I think it's really important for you to create your own checklist in life and acknowledge everything your child is doing, not to be able to go back to another parent and go, oh, look what my kid can do, but understand that the human condition can only learn so many things at once. So while your child may be delayed in potty training, they're probably advanced in some other area that's not on the list. And the reason why the other kids, right, are mastering these physical things is because they haven't started to master the intellectual side of the brain. No one's better. They're just different. And the bigger thing is that your majority is on a different path. So write your own checklist. Get other people to appreciate that checklist. You're going to all be happier for it. And I know Joy has a ton of resources.
So Marie, we'll come on to you. Final thoughts, and then Joy, we're gonna touch on your resources to finish off.
Okay. I would say check out the people with lived experience, because they're the ones who felt it. They're the ones who are going to get you through. Other parent carers, other individuals will give you a dig out. Have we got time? No, not really. We're always at maximum capacity, but we know how it feels, so we will always help. I would also say, remember these phrases, different, not less. Just because you do things differently, it doesn't mean to say the less. Don't give up. Everybody wrote my child up, right from the paediatrician who diagnosed him, who told me it'd be no good. So don't give up. Prove them wrong. Do it your way. Don't compare. Don't compare to other children of the same age, your friends' kids. You'll just do your own head in, because, you know, it's just negative after negative. Celebrate the small wins, because they will turn into big wins. And trust your instincts. You're the expert on your own child. Yeah. You will know them better than anyone else. And it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. So, you know, just keep going. And when you get the tough times, reach out. One of us will listen. One of us will help. And, you know, we'll make sure we get you through.
Amazing. Thank you. And Joy.
So several just resources for you. The first thing I want to tell you is remember the platinum rule. Treat others the way they want to be treated. I think that's an important distinction with our kids. Always assume the best. I really think that's an important starting point, is when things go awry, assume the best. I have put in the chat, you're going to offer, Theo, some resources. The first one is Jamie Heidel, who is an autistic herself, and she articulates what it's like to live in her body better than anybody that I've read. So follow her on LinkedIn. I've also provided three other sources, the LinkedIn guy, Stephen Sampson, and Dr. Eric Endlich. All three of these people have helped my son articulate and move on into university and to the workforce. Expressing who you are without saying I'm autistic. I think that's an important piece. A Manual of Me says, I need quiet places to work. I need uninterrupted work time. You can do that without saying, hey, I'm autistic, and people assuming things. And finally, I want to just leave you with a statement that Sean offered us when he was in a very, very dark place. But I think it's a powerful statement. Sean wrote when he was very, very low, and I said, go put something down in your journal. I was over it. I was exhausted. He came back to me with a statement. Sometimes I wish I were a caterpillar. I could close myself off from the world and still turn into something beautiful.
Really, there's no words after that. That is beautiful. And what a lovely way to end. I just wanted to put in as well, from the lovely Dave Thompson, who Joy, you introduced me to Dave. What a crew. Thanks for all you do. So there's another nice way from somebody within the community, another helpful, generous soul who provides a lot of the time, energy, and support to others. Listen, you three have been incredible. Clearly, we could just talk for another 3 hours, I think. We're literally scratching the surface of some of these topics. If you're interested in hearing some more, if there's some things you didn't hear, put it down. We can come back and we can do another session. We can, if everybody's willing, we can get everyone together again and continue the discussion moving forward. But it seems from the chat that everybody's had a great time. There's still a lot of barriers that people are facing. So we hear you, we're here for you. as much as we can be, and we'll share resources, groups, or anything else that can help and support you. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you to everybody who's joined us. You've been listening to Neurodiversity, eliminating kryptonite, enabling superheroes. Hope you enjoyed the show. You can like, share, comment, find us anywhere on any good podcasting host. You can also do some further reading up and buy my book, co-authored with Professor Amanda Kirby, Neurodiversity at Work. You can get it on Amazon with Kogan Page, our publisher, and pretty much any other good bookstore. Enjoy. Look forward to your feedback and keep listening to the show. Thank you.